They waited until the door closed after him, then resumed their seats. They did not look at one another. They had not heard the text of Directive Number 10-289, but they knew what it would contain. They had known it for a long time, in that special manner which consisted of keeping secrets from oneself and leaving knowledge untranslated into words. And by the same method, they now wished it were possible for them not to hear the words of the directive. It was to avoid moments such as this that all the complex twistings of their minds had been devised. They wished the directive to go into effect. They wished it could be put into effect without words, so that they would not have to know that what they were doing was what it was. Nobody had ever announced that Directive Number 10-289 was the final goal of his efforts. Yet for generations past, men had worked to make it possible. And for months past, every provision of it had been prepared for by countless speeches, articles, sermons, editorials, by purposeful voices that screamed with anger if anyone named their purpose. "The picture now is this," said Wesley Mooch. "The economic condition of the country was better the year before last than it was last year, and last year it was better than it is at present. It's obvious that we would not be able to survive another year of the same progression. Therefore, our sole objective must now be to hold the line, to stand still in order to catch our stride, to achieve total stability. Freedom has been given a chance and has failed. Therefore, more stringent controls are necessary. Since men are unable and unwilling to solve their problems voluntarily, they must be forced to do it." He paused, picked up the sheet of paper, then added in a less formal tone of voice, "Hell, what it comes down to is that we can manage to exist as and where we are, but we can't afford to move, so we've got to stand still. We've got to stand still. We've got to make those bastards stand still." His head drawn into his shoulders, he was looking at them with the anger of a man declaring that the country's troubles were a personal affront to him. So many men seeking favors had been afraid of him that he now acted as if his anger were a solution to everything, as if his anger were omnipotent, as if all he had to do was to get angry. Yet, facing him, the men who sat in a silent semicircle before his desk were uncertain whether the presence of fear in the room was their own emotion, or whether the hunched figure behind the desk generated the panic of a cornered rat. Wesley Mooch had a long, square face and a flat-topped skull, made more so by a brush haircut. His lower lip was a petulant bulb, and the pale brownish pupils of his eyes looked like the yolks of eggs, smeared under the not fully translucent whites. His facial muscles moved abruptly, and the movement vanished, having conveyed no expression. No one had ever seen him smile. Wesley Mooch came from a family that had known neither poverty nor wealth nor distinction for many generations. It had clung, however, to a tradition of its own, that of being college-bred, and therefore of despising men who were in business. The family's diplomas had always hung on the wall in the manner of a reproach to the world, because the diplomas had not automatically produced the material equivalents of their attested spiritual value. Among the family's numerous relatives, there was one rich uncle. He had married his money, and in his widowed old age he had picked Wesley as his favorite from among his many nephews and nieces, because Wesley was the least distinguished of the lot, and therefore, thought Uncle Julius, the safest. Uncle Julius did not care for people who were brilliant. He did not care for the trouble of managing his money either, so he turned the job over to Wesley. By the time Wesley graduated from college, there was no money to manage. Uncle Julius blamed it on Wesley's cunning, and cried that Wesley was an unscrupulous schemer. But there had been no scheme about it. Wesley could not have said just where the money had gone. In high school, Wesley Mooch had been one of the worst students, and had passionately envied those who were the best. College taught him that he did not have to envy them at all. After graduation, he took a job in the advertising department of a company that manufactured a bogus corn cure. The cure sold well, and he rose to be the head of his department. He left it to take charge of the advertising of a hair restorer, then of a patented brassiere, then of a new soap, then of a soft drink. And then he became advertising vice president of an automobile concern. He tried to sell automobiles as if they were a bogus corn cure. They did not sell. He blamed it on the insufficiency of his advertising budget. It was the president of the automobile concern who recommended him to Reardon. It was Reardon who introduced him to Washington. Reardon, who knew no standard by which to judge the activities of his Washington man. It was James Taggart who had given him a start in the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources, in exchange for double-crossing Reardon, in order to help Orrin Boyle, in exchange for destroying Dan Conway. From then on, people helped Wesley Mooch to advance, for the same reason as that which had prompted Uncle Julius. They were people who believed that mediocrity was safe. The men who now sat in front of his desk had been taught that the law of causality was a superstition, and that one had to deal with the situation of the moment without considering its cause. By situation of the moment, they had concluded that Wesley Mooch was a man of superlative skill and cunning, since millions aspired to power, but he was the one who had achieved it. It was not within their method of thinking to know that Wesley Mooch was the zero at the meeting point of forces unleashed in destruction against one another. "This is just a rough draft of Directive Number 10-289, said Wesley Mooch, "which Gene, Clem, and I have dashed off just to give you the general idea. We want to hear your opinions, suggestions, and so forth, you being the representatives of labor, industry, transportation, and the professions." Fred Kinnan got off the windowsill and sat down on the arm of a chair. Orrin Boyle spit out the butt of his cigar. James Taggart looked down at his own hands. Dr. Ferris was the only one who seemed to be at ease. "In the name of the general welfare," read Wesley Mooch, "to protect the people's security, to achieve full equality and total stability, it is decreed for the duration of the national emergency that, point one, all workers, wage earners, and employees of any kind whatsoever shall henceforth be attached to their jobs and shall not leave, nor be dismissed, nor change employment, under penalty of a term in jail. The penalty shall be determined by the Unification Board, such board to be appointed by the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources. All persons reaching the age of 21 shall report to the Unification Board, which shall assign them to where, in its opinion, their services will best serve the interests of the nation. Point two, all industrial, commercial, manufacturing, and business establishments of any nature whatsoever shall henceforth remain in operation, and the owners of such establishments shall not quit, nor leave, nor retire, nor close, sell, or transfer their business, under penalty of the nationalization of their establishment and of any and all of their property. Point three, all patents and copyrights pertaining to any devices, inventions, formulas, processes, and works of any nature whatsoever shall be turned over to the nation as a patriotic emergency gift by means of gift certificates to be signed voluntarily by the owners of all such patents and copyrights. The Unification Board shall then license the use of such patents and copyrights to all applicants equally and without discrimination for the purpose of eliminating monopolistic practices, discarding obsolete products, and making the best available to the whole nation. No trademarks, brand names, or copyrighted titles shall be used. Every formerly patented product shall be known by a new name and sold by all manufacturers under the same name, such name to be selected by the Unification Board. All private trademarks and brand names are hereby abolished. Point four, no new devices, inventions, products, or goods of any nature whatsoever not now on the market shall be produced, invented, manufactured, or sold after the date of this directive. The Office of Patents and Copyrights is hereby suspended. Point five, every establishment, concern, corporation, or person engaged in production of any nature whatsoever shall henceforth produce the same amount of goods per year as it, they, or he produced during the basic year, no more and no less. The year to be known as the basic or yardstick year is to be the year ending on the date of this directive. Over or under production shall be fined, such fines to be determined by the Unification Board. Point six, every person of any age, sex, class, or income shall henceforth spend the same amount of money on the purchase of goods per year as he or she spent during the basic year, no more and no less. Over or under purchasing shall be fined, such fines to be determined by the Unification Board. Point seven, all wages, prices, salaries, dividends, profits, interest rates, and forms of income of any nature whatsoever shall be frozen at their present figures as of the date of this directive. Point eight, all cases arising from and rules not specifically provided for in this directive shall be settled and determined by the Unification Board, whose decisions will be final.